This is something I have not written at all myself, because I'm fed up with my own writing. And I'm really sorry, but I'm going to try and do a kind of Italian accent as well.
Go on, hurry up.
But I kind of enjoyed it. Anyway, I wake up early, despite the fact that I function much better at night. I'm gifted to not need a lot of sleep. 5 hours is normal. 7 is luxury, but it's rare. I have a very busy schedule. I don't need to sleep. I go to the bathroom, then I drink a liter of water, which my dermatologist recommends to keep my skin lifted. I try not to have any meetings before 11:30 a.m. to allow me time to wake up properly. I like to relax, maybe make a few telephone calls in my dressing room. Do a little breakfast. I have plain yogurt with fresh fruit, some berries, half a banana and green tea, and often for breakfast I get out my diary. 3 times a week a man comes to give me a massage, but I'm not telling you who. It is secret. Or I do some yoga. And I love to walk in Hyde Park, but it's so difficult to find a time. Since I was a little child in Italy, people have looked at me not just because I am beautiful. It's just something else that comes from inside me. I know I'm fascinating, but I have preferred the word charisma to beauty. I've endured jealousy since I was small, but I don't care. I'm blessed. The most important thing I have is myself. And it's part of my culture to take care of me. I'm privileged to have good skin. It's not olive, you know, it's rose and very delicate. I dedicate a lot of time to cleansing and moisturizing. Lately I'm using a cream with vitamin C and collagen made especially for me, which gives a little lift for the evening. I love to look 30, like I look now, and it's my goal to look 30 at 70. Diet is important. You need to know about your metabolism. I always have salmon and mozzarella in my fridge, and I eat a lot of fruit, but no bread. I take a vitamins and minerals, and I have blood tests at the clinic every 6 months. When you're in the public eye like me, you need a 48-hour day just to take care of how you look. I phone my assistant Massimo, or he comes to my place and we go over things. I love clothes, but I hate to go shopping, so Massimo calls and they send clothes to me. I have a lot of meetings which I do like to do, lunch over Berkeley in Knightsbridge, 10 minutes from where I live, or Claridge's or the Ivy Club. I don't know anyone who does as much as I do. I'm a lawyer, first of all. I do public affairs. Call it lobbying. I do special networking for firms in Italy, America and the UK. But it's boring to do one thing, so I write. I'm working on a novel, also a book about travel and food. And I want to co-produce 2 big projects on TV, but I can't mention them. I wish one day there will be a movie about how I spend my day, because it's quite intense. I'm a very loved person. Women and men, they both love me. And this is because I'm the kindest person I know. I'm never rude, which is important. But the characteristic I'm most proud of is that I do love to spoil my man. And if you can't spoil your man, if you don't know how to spoil yourself, you can spoil your man, which I do. I'm not a feminist. I'm feminine. It's my nature to put my man first. And I've always adjusted my life to this. I did it with my first husband. And my second. And I'll do it again with a new man in my life. I never wanted children. I knew when I was pregnant it wasn't what I wanted. I felt it completely overwhelmed because I would have had no time for me. But I'm like a mother to my man. I shower him with attention. Physical, material, and psychological, it is what I love. And I require attention back because I know how good I am. Sometimes it gets quite stressful. I'm special, you know. So you're going to have a very intense and unique experience with me. But at the same time, I'm very demanding. It's not easy. But then, who cares for easy things?
All right. Next we have Billy Ryan.
This is just something I'm working on there at the moment. Someone just said to me once that you should write a poem from a woman's point of view. So I come up with this. Come to me. Come to me across the karst esplanade. I give you permission. Safe conduct over and through the wheat quiet, the crocus trail, past the watchman's hut, to my blows stitched from silences, my sleeves manufactured from silences. You have leave, you can enter, scuff dust from your walking boots at my threshold east of the fields. Though you cannot leave from my house through the meshwork of machine noise, come to me. Though you must always be stationed with an earshot of the train yard, on streets built from humming and sirens, built without exit from gear crunch and traffic drone, come to me, though you can never come. I will breathe carefully onto your nape, my breasts against your back, my copper form, as the breeze seasons hibiscus in my chamber, seasons the silences with salt from the gravelly shore, or just breathe like this, into your ear like this, so come to me. Come, come though you can't, across the ragged karst, the wheat that is buttery or done. My blouse is stitched with the quiet of the burning grass, my sleeves with eight versions of silence. Come to me, come. Thanks.
Okay, on the subject of men writing from a woman's perspective. This is a poem where the first half is from a man's perspective and the second half is the same event from a woman's perspective. After lunch in August swelter, prone upon a narrow cot, sun rays fingering through a welter of blinds, Venetian metal hot. Simulacrum of forest dapple light, or the shade of day kissing night. In such shade might a blushing, reticent schoolgirl debut in a discotheque. In strode Corinna, dripping, magnificent, dreadlocks stroking her glistening neck, as proud and brazen as Kate Moss, striding a catwalk radiating gloss. Her showering gown hung airily agape, stirred up enough, I rawly seized its cuffs, grabbing like a baited ape. Faking modesty, she smiled and teased, then momentarily faked a headache, then dropped her gown as in mistake. Her naked sight made my torpid brain swirl, not one blemish on her skin, not a zit could I see as she turned in a twirl. Whoa, my fingers on her pert, neat tit, my cheek on her shoulder little fat, her geodesic buttock and her stomach flat. No need to list you more, she was swell. In fervid humour she pulled, down we fell. You easily can guess the rest. Well, if such moments happen only once, eternity's hell. This is the same event from the other side. Perspective. How such an indolent bastard acquired such Nureyev-shaped pins, I'll never know. But as they laid knees down in the musty cot, light slicing his body like best Sheffield, I wanted to run my tongue over his contoured downy outline, see him turn slowly like Johnny Depp in my daydreams, and unfold his broad shoulders like wings, feel hands used to spinning rhymes spin my brain with their snake-like enwrappments. But he woke too soon, and almost froze me with the gormlessness of his Pavlovian eagerness. The gun I had started to drop, I retied with a breathless growl. I was caught up by his bluntness. That's when he grabbed me and I giggled at his idiocy. He had me then and it was only okay. He fell a snoring afterwards, plonker. Thank God it's not like this every time.
Thanks, Matt. Next we have Comskull.
This is a poem actually by somebody else. A friend of mine, Michael Morrissey from Cork, he died about 18 years ago, around this time of year. He was 27 at the time, he was in Japan. And this is a poem written by him. It's called Handheld, and the inspiration for the poem was, I think he told me, he was in a train traveling to Tokyo. And he saw this girl sitting across from him in the carriage, and she was looking at her hand, so that's the inspiration for the poem. Handheld. She's waiting, sitting. Now a palm reader. Lining her pockets. Folding a fist. Stretching applause. They tangle in embrace. Fortune of stories lie in the future. Blind man's path, follow their flow, feel more than see, the Thomas's doubt, the finger to the cane, slow fade no more, so short she thinks, drops in oceans, is that what he said, streams running dry, smooth riverbed, where were you?
Next we have Colin McManus.
Thanks, Rob. I'm trying to recite this. Ticket for Paula Cunningham. Today I found the ticket that you bought. Date, time, seat number, and a light blue stripe down one side. Not selected, it reads, whatever that means. I touch where you touched, and the memories of you returning, laughing, searching for your glasses, buttoning up your coat to leave. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Paul. Next we have Richard Key.
I'm not quite sure what to call this, so I'll just start into it. Over the pathways of my mind, intertwined in a cavorting mesh of moments, searching for words, occasionally finding order enough among themselves to be put to paper. Distracting tangents fly and circle like buzzards, anticipating the carcass that this lexicon of verse may soon be set aside for them to peck at. Its faults, its lack of rhythm or rhyme or pace or feeling, picked clean, till no trace is remembered of the place it once held in the corridors of my creativity. But sometimes one in ten or less may survive the buzzard's intent when alchemy creates a bond that gels these random words, finding order and companionship with each other. Their embryonic frame finds some satisfaction in a poet's critical gaze and surgical pen. And then it is born into the world to find a life of its own. In time, it stands alone. In time, it walks. In time, it talks to you, finding no more or no less praise or criticism than it will stand for. It is what it is, and it will be what you make it. Like life itself, it's a poem. It was mine, now it's yours. Finished, for now at least.
Kieran McCarthy.
Cheers. This is called Reproject. We are looking for an artist on whom we'll pin our hopes. We will live through them for our own lives, our hopes. And we'll just stay unhappy like those regular folks, unfulfilled and comfortable, numbed and provoked, but not called to action yet. For beneath doubt's cloak, we have lost all self-respect and we've begun to choke on the passion in our vision until clear dreams have broke. Now they just sound bitter, those words that you spoke. Either we've fallen for sweet dimness, or the light's too bright. Our hearts have hardened and our bodies so tight. We've lost all engagement with what's wrong and what's right. And the fires of the day burn blue smoke in the night. And we worship its beauty and pray for it to stay, but it was just a fleeting moment that's come and gone away. We grow stale in desire and linger in the grey, caught up on the wire, snagged on our way. And the only path to freedom is to take a backward step. Gather your thoughts a moment. Let your vision reflect. Engage with your spirit. With your senses, reconnect. Turn again to face the future and reproject.
I met a friend of mine a couple of years ago. I hadn't met him for a long time, and I shook hands with him. This is not an empty smoke. And he had two fingers and stuck to his hand. I asked him what was wrong with his fingers, and he said that what the doctor told me to pack up bags. Or let's get them amputated. So next time I met him, his fingers were missing. And he said to me, the doctor told me that if I don't stop, I could have my leg amputated. And the next time I met him, he had only one leg.
This is a true story.
Yeah. So he was, he's one of the funniest fellows you can meet. So he said, if I don't stop, he told me that I could lose the other leg. So the next time I met him, he came in a wheelchair and he had no legs. And we had a party one night at Christmas time, and he arrived kind of late, about 12 o'clock. And he'd been somewhere else prior to that. And one of the lads who hadn't seen him for a long time said, "Hello, Christy." He said, "I haven't seen you for ages. Where are you?" And he said, "I'm legless."
Yeah.
He was a bit steamed up with him. So this is called Missing Things. A bit funny. He woke one morning and his hand was missing, his working hand. What was left for him to do? Right, he said, I'll get over it. I'll become ambidextrous. But he couldn't. Next morning he realized he could not see. He could see with only one eye. Something is eating me, he thought. He should have smelt a rat, but one nostril had dropped from his face overnight without his knowing. Despite all of this, he carried on regardless, until one morning the social welfare man called to his door and said, you'll be needing these, and handed him a pair of sleek wooden crutches. Disarmed, he thought, these things will be useless as half a scissors. I must speak to someone, he said, then realized that his tongue was missing. He must have swallowed it. And then he forgot his name. His post box overgrew with ivy. The welfare man returned to tell him he existed no longer. When they eventually found him asleep in bed, there was no smell. His faint smile suggested a serene saintliness. And so they buried him in the graveyard of lost souls, where no one ever goes to lay flowers.
So, next we have Emily Davis Fletcher.
This is my best friend recently got married, and it kind of made me like really reflect on like my life and or our time together, and kind of like there's no going back now. Even though like I'm married, I didn't kind of have that kind of existential crisis like I did when she got married. So this kind of deals with that. So. Heather breathed yes into me, like a flesh and bone key, lithe and smiling, top teeth leaned back toward the headwater of her laughter, superior, directed at her perceived flaws, trusting me above all to throw her skull in a field, stump scientists with her back bound in incisors, because she could be the missing link, a highly evolved hair, the answer to fear, as fundamental as yes, to testing the college air in her ivy convertible, rain locked inside the doors, seeping through the floor, sloshing like a bucket half full as we turned heads, then corners, with photos of nude men glued to the hood and hubcaps, just Mary splashed across the trunk. Yes to spray painting the strip club where my sister worked, my words weak and exposed to attack, like a crotch propped up by her letters, long and lean, like soldiers' legs, artistically trained, till the owner paid to have the wall painted black. Yes to lives by the sea, matrifocal like thick-skinned island women, raise our future children in one broad house with back door and swinging gate, sign with relief when men come and go. Heather collects me at the airport, giftless except for guilt. I search for signs she's been untrue as we bisect takeoffs and landings in her second-hand silver sedan, sand in the seat cracks and under feet. The AC beats back our hair. My breath shallow till I ask if she's still flirting with the idea of taking his name. Once she confessed to sabotaging a Sundance. Her buried blood drew suspicion from an old Lakota woman, and I had to drive her shame away with wild, cramping laughter. Funny, she never sensed the negative pull of my blood that caused me to lose her letters, abandon our future children and home, smash her skull into 1,000 dead seeds on rocks where I've settled with a drunk, echoing no. No, I find her unchanged, teeth laid back, cutting plans for me to catch the bouquet as we glide onto her street. Tree-fingered light throws her profile on my lap, smiling, half blind to how far I am from sailing through summer, and her ivy convertible, rain locked inside the doors, licking our toes, sloshing like a bucket half full as we pull away from our fluorescent destination, milkshakes between our thighs, the moon in hot pursuit, like a sun-bleached sail, slicing through darkness.
Thanks, Emily. That's have time for one or two more poems if anybody wants to charge up here.
Joe.
Oh, Joe.
Oh, this is a poem in progress. It's called Postman of Meaning, or alternatively, The Poet. I am a poet of scant means, a postman of meaning. Do you open the letters I deliver? I am your postman of meaning. You may not hear me knock, just see a figure disappearing. A figure disappearing into early morning mist, a trail of footprints on blank snow, blown away in the wind like the emptying pages of life. I deliver meaning. I send a secret truth. I send sealed messages. Be watchful. Be vigilant. Be open. Though I come, I might not knock. You may miss me. One day, when I am no more, you will miss me. I listen for the song of the stars, the story of the world. What I hear, I write. What I write, I bring to you. I am the lonely whine of wind, the crash of waves on moonlit beaches. I carve the shadow of love, the outline of beauty. I seek the ring of truth. I seek the way of wisdom to put it down in words. I shape things into what they are not in order to show what they are. No saint am I, no prophet. I am a poet who sees, feels, and thinks. I bring letters for you to open. I am your postman of meaning. I deliver the truth I know. Before leaving over the blank snow. Thank you.
Well, Joe, yourself, do you have a poem for the open mic? I noticed that the list didn't get to use. I'm talking to you.
Oh, sorry.
I'm
okay.
Yeah, that's right. I'm looking straight at you.
Okay. Look like you're looking through me.
Yeah. Okay, just to finish you off. So, from the 12th century in Japan, there was a poet there. His name was Kamo no Chomi. You have to forgive my Japanese pronunciation. he was a big deal as a poet. He was one of the favourites of the emperor, but he took against it and he rejected materialism and he went off and lived in the mountains and built his own shack. And so he wrote this book as a kind of meditation on the whole thing. And I came across it in the flea market in York Street. It's a little book, beautiful paper, beautiful, pen drawings and all the rest of it, published by Dolman Press. I don't know what you pay for it now, you probably pay 70 or 80 euros. It's called Notebook of a 10 Square Rush Mat Sized World. And so it has ever been. In this world, nothing is constant. We ourselves and our dwellings too are inconstant. What must a man endure to gain status or establish a home? If a man of low station place himself under the protection of another, he may thereby obtain certain advantages, but he will never be assured enduring peace. If he should suffer some misfortune, he cannot, in deference to his master, raise his voice or cry out in grief. He is always worried about promotion or disgrace, and even his movements must be guarded, lest they offend. Indeed, he is like a sparrow, too close to the nest of a hawk. A poor man cannot live in peace as neighbour to a rich man. Day and night he is aware of his shabbiness. He feels unable to come or go without offending, without offering the tribute of adulation. His heart is never at ease, because he is conscious of his neighbour's disdain and of the envy of his own wife and household. If a man live in a narrow, crowded street, how can he avoid sorrow or loss if a fire break out in his quarter? If he live in an out-of-the-way section, it is inconvenient to get about, and he must live in constant fear of robbers. A man of ambition is immured in greed and ambition. A man who lives alone is despised by his fellows. A man of possessions is prey to endless trouble. A man who has little is gnawed by constant anxiety. If a man accept the protection of another, he becomes that man's slave. If a man offer protection to another, he exposes himself to entangling sentiments. If a man accept the ways of the world, he violates himself. If a man rejects its ways, he is considered insane. What can a man do? Where could he live? Where can he seek refuge? Where can he know peace for even the span of a jade bell's tinkle?